All right, so we're gonna kick this off. Hi there, I'm Carla Anderson. I'm in stakeholder engagement and communications at the ISO. And Ad, if you just wanna move it to the recording, our notice. We will be recording this session and posting it on our website. So just our notice that we will be doing that. And the collection of the personal information by the ISO for this session is just for the purpose of this session, and it's collected in accordance with the FOIP. If you have any questions or concerns, the email, phone number are there on the screen, and that's the deck that's been posted on the website. If we can move forward. Thank you, everyone, for attending. The purpose of this session, we are here to provide an update regarding the reasons for the BC Montana Interties trip, system performance during the event, and the mitigations implemented in order to reduce the risk of impacting customers in Alberta from such system events in the future. This is also to provide a forum to address stakeholder questions. As you can see, this is the registration. Got a large list of attendees across the board, and this was as of July 24. So if your company registered after this date, we don't have this posted, but we've probably had another 50 people join as of this. So we'll move to the next slide. Thanks, Ada. This is the ISO rolled out its stakeholder engagement framework in January of this year, and these are our principles. And this is our approach to engagement, being inclusive and accessible, strategic and coordinated, transparent and timely, and customized and meaningful. And as we move through this information session, participation of everyone here is critical, and we want to give everyone the opportunity to participate. So we just ask you to listen to understand others' perspectives, disagree respectfully, balance airtime fairly, and keep an open mind. And now, this is just in order to, with the Zoom webinar, I'm just gonna go through a couple housekeeping on how to ask questions as we move through the information session. So all attendees, if this is the first time you've joined a Zoom webinar, you join in listen-only mode, and your attendee cameras are disabled and your microphones are muted. When asking or typing in a question, please state the organization that you work for and your first and last name so that we know who's asking the question and we can address you as such. Two ways to ask questions during the Q&A portion. There will be two natural breaks as we move through the presentation. Well, there'll be opportunities at those times to raise your virtual hand and ask your question, as well as at the end of the presentation. So if you'd like to ask a question, you can click the icon to raise your hand. We'll see that you've raised your hand. We'll unmute your microphone. There'll then be a request to you to unmute yourself, and then you'll ask your question. You can also ask questions throughout the presentation by typing them into the Q&A window. And you can click the Q&A button next to raise a hand. And after you type in your question, or you can see the other questions that other attendees have asked, you can upvote questions that have already been asked. We can just move to the next slide. So where to access this raise your hand or the Q&A function? If you're on a 2-in-1, a tablet, PC, Mac, just hover your cursor over the bottom area of the Zoom app and the controls will appear. There's a raise hand, and then once you raise it, it'll say lower hand, or you can tap the Q&A button. If you're using a smartphone, you'll just see those, the raise hand, lower hand, or typing into the Q&A. So those will be where you access those controls. And if you have phoned in, Ada, we can just move to slide 10. If you're calling in kind of via conference call, so you're not using the video portion of Zoom, if you would like to ask a question during the Q&A portion, on your phone's dial pad, you just hit *9, and then we will be able to see that you've raised your virtual hand. We will then unmute your microphone. In turn, you will need to unmute your microphone by hitting *6. And *6 toggles you between mute and unmute. So that's just something to remember for those people that have called in with no video. And the presentation has been posted on our website, so you can find that there. And I think that's the last one. So I'm going to pass this over to Dennis to do some introductions. Dennis?
Thanks, Carla. For those who don't know me, I'm Dennis Frelick. I'm the Vice President of Grid Reliability here at the ISO. And we've got two individuals joining me today to go through the presentation. The first is Ada Raymond. He's our Director of Grid Planning and Operations Engineering, and he will take us through the majority of the material throughout the presentation and answer any questions that may come up as we go through the material. We also have Biju Gopi, who is our Manager of Operations Engineering and Market Support. And Biju is here to assist with more detailed questions, as his team has been primarily accountable for all the investigation analysis and actions we've identified and taken forward with as a result of this this event. So look forward to your guys' engagement and questions and feedback as we go through the presentation. A couple things for context setting. As Carla indicated, we are going to go through the event and go through the detailed analysis and the action plans we've taken so far. And so you'll get a good feel for a fair bit of detail in that respect in the presentation. You also see that a key concern for us is the generator response that we received during the event. And I am in the process of engaging senior leaders at those generation plant companies and sites to both express our concerns with their performance and response to the event and seek actions to have them investigate improvements that can be made at their sites to improve their frequency response to these types of events. And we'll be looking to seek actions that give us confidence that go forward events will get better performance. In parallel, we will be looking at our rules process and our rules as it relates to generator frequency response to see if there's anything additional we need to consider within our rules to help ensure we can get improved performance, actual performance from our generation fleet here in the province in response to these types of frequency events. So one of my messages is that's a primary concern for us as an ISO as we've gone through both this event and past related frequency events. the other thing you should see or notice is the action we've taken to date has been to, the way I describe it, is de-risk the risk to Albertans in this province to being exposed to being tripped for high opportunity import into the province. And we've gone through that with some analysis and increasing our confidence level for those types of events. And hopefully you'll understand as we go through the material how we concluded to where we've landed so far in that respect. And I would describe those de-risking as an interim measure until we have confidence that the generator response in the province will be improved, and as well as have confidence around the load response and our frequency services responses that we are counting on to mitigate for these types of events. So with that context setting, I'll turn it over to Ada to take us through the material, and we look forward to any questions and feedback you may have as we conclude today's session. Ada?
Thank you, Dennis, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, in this session, we are going to talk about what happened on June 7th, why it happened, what worked and what did not. We'll look at historical system performance and trends for various parameters. We put in some mitigation measures, so we'll discuss those mitigation measures and the next steps. During the presentation, we'll break at a couple of places so we can take questions from you. It's a long presentation, we recognize that. And so it's better if we can, if we break at a couple of points and locations and take questions. So I'm requesting you to hold off your verbal questions till the break points. And at the end of the presentation as well, we should have ample opportunity for any remaining questions and have a Q&A session then as well. With that, let's go to the presentation and talk about what exactly happened on June 7th. But before we do that, the first slide shows a typical frequency response characteristics. We have included this just as a good refresher for everyone. We will be talking about the frequency response in details in the coming slides. We have taken this diagram from NERC publications. And if we can focus on the upper diagram, point A is when the disturbance is initiated and the frequency drops down to point C. Right? This is the lowest point on the frequency curve, and it's called the frequency nadir point. And at that point, the rebound period starts, the frequency starts to recover and goes to point B and D, and then onwards towards the original level of 60 hertz. Please keep in mind that the slope of the curve from point A to C depends on the system inertia, as well as the speed of the primary frequency control systems. Lower the inertia, steeper is the curve from point A to C, and lower is the location of point C. The lower is the nadir point. Now let's focus on the bottom graph or bottom picture, where we present the primary, secondary, and tertiary frequency control timelines. The primary frequency control consists of governor response and frequency-dependent load responses. It immediately kicks in after the event, and its impact lasts for quite a few seconds. It goes into the minutes. The secondary frequency control system mainly consists of automatic generation control that's installed on many of the machines, and it kicks in about 20 to 30 seconds typically and lasts for a few minutes when the tertiary frequency control kicks in, which is mainly the operator action or the operator dispatch, and it takes us through the trajectory of recovery to the 60 hertz level. So it's a good refresher for everyone, and we will be talking about the point A and especially the frequency nadir point C and our recovery period in the later slides. So please keep the slide in mind when we're talking about the actual event. So let's see what happened on June 7th. Most of us know that the event happened at around 2:50 in the afternoon, when there was a lightning strike on the BC side of the 1201, the 500 kV tie line between Alberta and BC. At the time of the event, the scheduled imports were 909 megawatts. And these imports were on the BC, Alberta-BC tie line, as well as Mattel tie line. So it's the sum of the scheduled imports. The actual flow on the intertie was 923 megawatts. So there was a slight difference between the scheduled imports and the actual flow on the interties, which is nothing unusual. There's nothing unusual about it. The Alberta internal load was slightly above 8,760 megawatts. The wind was quite high at 930 megawatts in the province, and about 180 megawatts of LSSI was armed at that time, just prior to the event. Now, having high imports and high wind generation is not a unique situation. It's not a unique condition, but it certainly is not very common. We do see this occurring from time to time, but it's not very common that we have very high imports and very high wind generation. Once the lightning strike happened, the tide tripped. The frequency dropped to 59.15 hertz, which is the lowest point or the nadir point C that we discussed in the previous slide. Accompanying that, we had a load shedding of about 400 megawatts approximately. That included the three under frequency load shedding blocks, the D1, D2, and D3. And we'll talk about these in details in later slides, as well as 188 megawatts of LSSI was shed. Just an overview of the frequency response. As I mentioned, the event happened at around 2:50 in the afternoon. The frequency dropped to below 59.2, to 59.15 hertz to be exact. And then it started to recover and it recovered to about 59.5 hertz level, and then it came back. And then it started to recover again and touched about 59.5 and then came back again. And so it hovered around the 59.5 hertz level for about 4 minutes before continuing its trajectory towards the 60 hertz level. And now this 4 minute time period of hovering around or wobbling around, whatever the word is, around 59.5 is quite unusual. And we will talk about it later on in the when we are analyzing the event in detail. Let's go to the next slide that presents the overall picture, the overall system response. The upper curve shows the frequency generation and load response. The frequency response is shown as the blue curve, which is exactly the same as we saw in the previous slide. At 250, the event happened, it dropped to below 59.2, started to recover, touched 59.5, and then hovered around 59.5 for about 4 minutes before continuing its trajectory towards the original level of 60 hertz. And it recovered to 60 hertz in about seven, eight minutes. Of interest is the red line, which is the generation response of the system. You can see that the, immediately after the event, the governor action resulted in a power boost, initial power boost at around 20 second mark, where it reached its maximum, and then it started to gradually come down. And it came down consistently without going back up. And it continued for the whole period that we are showing here. Please note that the power just kept coming down while the frequency was hovering around 59.5. So the power response did not really help the frequency, did not provide the necessary support to the frequency because the frequency was much below the 60 hertz level. The green line on the upper curve shows the load response, and that includes the LSSI load of 188 megawatts that was shed, as well as the under frequency load shed that we observed, as well as the frequency dependence of load. This is also incorporated in this load response. We saw about 190 megawatts of load reduction as a result of the frequency dependence of load in Alberta. So this is the overall picture of the system response. Let's focus on some of the directives in the lower graph. We had the spinning reserve. We are showing the spinning reserve, the supplemental generation, and the supplemental load directives and the timelines as blue, red, and green lines. And you can see that within about a minute or so, that's 60 seconds or so of the event happening, the directives started to be issued. And they were the directive continued for about 144 seconds. But of interest is the purple graph, which shows the response of the generators that were on contingency reserves. The initial part of the purple curve that goes up from zero to about approximately 350 megawatts would be the governor response of all those generators that were on contingency, that were supposed to provide contingency reserves. And then there was a withdrawal, the output started to come down. And at around 184 second mark, the contingency reserves would have kicked in. And so the power output started to increase again. So this is just a deep dive of exactly what happened at 250 and events immediately after that. Let's talk about another important parameter in this whole equation, which is system inertia. Here we are presenting the system inertia as well as the net demand data from the beginning of the year. And you can see a clear lowering trend starting from January towards June. And that would be because of the, we were going from winter months into the spring time frame, but also around end of February, beginning of March, the COVID-19 situation had an impact on the net demand. And similarly, the system in Asia would also decrease. And it would also decrease because of the additions of renewables in the province. But we can see a clear reduction or lowering trend as we move from January towards June of this year. The inertia at the time of the event was observed as 47.1 GVAS or gigavolt ampere seconds. Traditionally, in our analysis of historical events for the past 8 years or so, we have observed the system inertia to be between 50 and 60 gigavolt ampere seconds. So at the time of the event, we observed that the system inertia was lower than what we had observed historically. And as I mentioned before, the inertia impacts the rate of change of frequency. It impacts the slope of the curve from point A to C. On June 7th, we observed that the rate of change of frequency was 0.5 hertz per second, which is very, very serious, very fast. So there, in our opinion, there are two main factors, two main reasons for the system underperformance. One is the low inertia, which is caused by high renewables and high intertidal flow at the time of the event. And this also, there's a third factor, which is lower demand because of the COVID-19 situation. And so the studied range, as I mentioned before, historically had been between 50 and 60 gigavolt ampere seconds, but the actual pre-contingency inertia was 47.1 GVS. The other main reason for the system underperformance is the governor, generator governor response. Dennis talked about it in his introduction. The generator governor response is described as the response or the change in generator response in megawatts per 0.1 hertz change in frequency. And historically, in all of the events that we have analyzed, we observed generator response between 88 and 102 megawatts per 0.1 hertz. But on June 7th, the observed response was around 77 megawatts per 0.1 hertz. And it dropped to 40 megawatts per 0.1 hertz as we moved from the nadir point. So that is a very, very serious situation where we saw a very poor response from the generators. So in our opinion, these were the two main factors, but there are a number of factors that come into play, and we'll talk about it in the later slides. Here we are presenting a historical perspective of the generator response and the load response based on our analysis, on our studies that we have carried out recently. Let's talk about the generator response first. When we carried out a study to identify the volume of LSSI needed for facilitating imports in 2017, we analyzed a lot of historical events. And based on the analysis, we assumed a generator response of around 102 megawatts per 0.1 hertz. In the 2019 study, when we wanted to update the study, we again analyzed a lot of historical events. And based on our observation, we assumed a generator response of around 90 megawatts per 0.1 hertz. But on June 7th, we actually saw a generator response much lower than these two numbers, which was 77 megawatts per 0.1 hertz. And actually it dropped to 40 megawatts per 0.1 hertz. So there's a clear trend of lowering trend of generator response as we move from 2017 to the June 7th event. The load response, on the other hand, is a different story. The load response is defined as the percentage change in load for 1% change in frequency. It's a ratio, the damping constant is a ratio. In 2017, based on our analysis, we assumed a load response of about slightly above 2 But in 2019, it dropped to about 1.9. But on June 7th, we saw a load damping constant of about 2.5%. So it's all over the place. It's good to see some improvement. But the trend for generator response is very, very clear. All right, so we have talked about the typical frequency response characteristics. We talked about what happened on June 7th, what were the conditions, and what was the bigger picture, the system responses. So I'm going to take a break here and see if we have any questions, and we'll try to answer the questions here.
So, Ed, it looks like we've got a couple in the Q&A. Oh, we've got a couple attendees that have just raised their virtual hand.
Okay. I'm reading the Q&A. What percentage of load was wind and solar at the time of the event? I don't have the numbers right now in front of me, Biju, but I would, if I were to guess, I would say it would be, wind would be at a very high percentage because it was very cloudy. It was raining in Calgary and in southern Alberta. So solar, the little amount of solar that we have wouldn't be of any significant output.
That's right, Atta. So we hardly had any solar, so it was around 930 megawatt of wind and about 8764 of load. So that would translate to roughly, say, 12% of the overall fuel mix at that particular time.
12% of it. Okay. Has the ISO ever looked at asking AltaLink to add shield wire to 1201L to provide some additional lightning protection? The answer is no. My understanding is that the soil conditions in the Alberta BC corridor is such that the shield wire may not be very effective. But the answer is no, we have not asked AltaLink to install shield wire. Would higher LSSI load be of any help in this kind of events? Yes, and we will talk about it. That higher LSSI would be of help. But again, we'll talk in the later slides that this is a very complex event. I mean, there are a number of factors that come into play when an event happens. So it's not just the LSSI, but the generator response, the load response, and the under-frequency load shedding, system inertia. There are a number of factors that come into play, but higher LSSI will certainly help. Could the ASO operators or other TFOs have done anything different to help with the grid recovery? My understanding is that power was put on within a couple of hours, and so the system controllers and of course the TFO controllers and the TFO control centers, in my opinion, did a fantastic job in putting the system back or with the recovery. That's all I can say right now. How is the load damping constant calculated during the event? How does inertia embedded in the demand affect this number? Did you want to take that, the curve that we analyze from point C to B?
For sure.
D, yeah.
For sure. So, yeah, so like Atta mentioned earlier, inertia is one of the key components that determines your how steep the slope is from going from A to C, and that's the rate of change of frequency. So just from this event, the rate of change of frequency was around 0.5 hertz per second, which is quite significant compared to previous events when we had, 0.4 or below. So that by itself is a concern. And inertia is generally calculated as the inertia constant of all the online generators at that point, multiplied by the MVA to give you the gigavolt ampere dot second unit. So that's where we come to the 47.1. The other piece is, so we had the inertia calculation. The load damping constant is basically the change in load for a percentage change in frequency. So we see what the load response was at point A. So that's the time, just at the exact instance when the contingency happened. And then we measure load at point B. And point B is defined as an average of 20 to 52 seconds after the event. And that's basically the natural load response because of the frequency deviation that we observe in any system. And then we take that delta, so we know how much load moved or got reduced because of the loss, change of deviation frequency, and then convert that to a unitized value. So that pretty much gives you a ratio of what we refer to commonly as the load damping constant. And that all that says is the change in percentage change in load for the percent, for 1% change in frequency.
Thank you, Biju. Daiso, in response to the lightning strike, has reduced the ATC. Why is the ATC reduced when there is no lightning in Alberta or BC? So immediately after the event, we did reduce the ATC to 550 megawatts because we didn't have any data, any information immediately after the event. So we wanted to understand what worked, what did not, what exactly happened. So we were in the process of investigating, investigation and collecting data. And at the same time, we did not want a repeat of the June 7th event. That is why we put the ATC at limited the ATC at 550 megawatts until we got some information about what worked, what did not, what were the reasons. And as you, and we'll talk about it in later slides, but as you know now, we have put in some additional mitigation measures, but we have lifted that limitation from the ATC. We have put in some new LSSI tables, and we'll talk about it in later slides. How much how much has early coal retirement affected system inertia? In particular, is the early 2020 inertia degradation the same as years past before coal retirements? It is. The coal retirements has happened, but at the same time, we are also having rotating machinery, a new generation coming, new rotating generation coming online. So it's very difficult to point out the difference in inertia right now, with coal retiring and new generation coming online. But at the same time, with the increase in renewables, there are certain times of the day or certain conditions when we can have heavy imports and high wind generation, as we saw on June 7th. And these are the conditions that we have to watch. And we've been watching it. We have been studying all those conditions. And in fact, we identified, not an issue, but we identified that the inertia needs to be monitored on a regular basis last year. But our studies so far had assumed an economic merit order, but these extreme conditions sometimes do happen. And when there's an event, when there's a disturbance during those extreme events, that's when things start to happen. In other jurisdictions, such as Ontario, they reduce ATC on lines when lightning is in the area, but restore to full ATC when no lightning is in the area. Is this happening in Alberta? Yes, that is exactly what is happening. We have put in some special precautionary measures only for the time periods when there's a lightning storm passing through the Alberta-BC tie line corridor. And once the storm goes away, we are back to normal operation, which is very common in Ontario and other jurisdictions. Was 1201L experiencing single pole trip and reclose events from lightning in the periods prior to the event? I don't have that data, but I do know that most of the outages that happen in that corridor is because of inclement weather, because of lightning. That's all I can say right now. Whether there was single pole trip and reclose, we'll have to dig our data to respond to this question.
That's right, Atta. So yeah, we are all, you know, single pole trip and reclose would have helped, but we did look at historical number of outages across the past 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And we did see that 20% of them are sustained outages. So single pole trip and reclose did not help. And of course, you know, half of those instances were due to inclement weather, mainly lightning along the corridor. So, so if that helps as well.
Ada, if we want to just go, we've got a, someone raising their hand.
Sorry, okay. My apologies.
So,
Carla, I need your help.
Oh, yeah. So, it looks like, they just lowered their hand. So,
back to Q&A?
Yeah, back to Q&A. And if that was a malfunction, please raise your hand again. But go back to the Q&A. Thanks, Ada.
Okay. There's no lightning today, but the ATC has been reduced. That is true, and that may be because we don't have enough LSSI, or contingency reserve, the frequency support services available, and that's why ATC has been may have been reduced. Can I also share more information? Sorry. Can I also share more information about UVLS and under frequency load shed schedule and how they are spread over different nodes geographically in the AIS? This will help with the risk assessment by major industrial facilities up north, typically at major risk of islanding during winter. I'll take this question away and respond. We do have the information, but I'll check about the confidentiality and then respond back. As part of our Black Start services, we do look at different scenarios and make sure that we are fully prepared for any event where there is any danger of a part of the system being islanded. And so every year we do carry out that exercise and manage the Black Start situation well. Was there any lightning warning prior to the event? It scrolled down actually. Was the strike a single phase or multi-phase? If single phase, why was it not cleared by the single phase trip and reclose on the BC side? I guess it was a three-phase fault, and that's why it was the line, the tie line tripped. But that's subject to check. We'll reconfirm this.
When we get back. That's right, Atta. It was a three-phase trip.
Yeah.
Ada, I would suggest you continue to work through the presentation materials, and then, because there'll be lots of questions that might get answered as you go through the additional materials, and then we can answer all the questions towards the end.
Sure. Okay, so let's continue our discussion on the historical trends and performances. The first one is the system inertia trend. We talked about the inertia trend during the year, but here is the scatter plot for the past couple of years. And again, the trend is very clear that in 2019, we had higher inertia in general compared to the first few months of this year. And that I think is because of some increase in renewables as well as the COVID-19 situation, which has resulted in a lower net demand. So the trend is very clear in terms of inertia. Last year it ranged between 50 and 60 GVAS gigavolt ampere seconds, and we can see that this year it's come down. It is hovering between 54 and 44 GVAS. Here is a scatter plot of the historical events in terms of generator response, generation response. We have gone back till 2012, and the circles, small circles, represent events that happened when the Alberta system was already islanded and we had a generation dropping event. The square, small squares, represent events when we lost the intertie and became islanded. The blue color represents when we triggered LSSI, low charge service for imports. The orange square, and there's only one here, represents when both load shed service for imports and UFLS triggered. And the gray plots show that there was an event, but there was no load lost during that event. And from this scatter plot, you can see that the orange square lies pretty low on with respect to the historical data. It's on the lower side. And that is exactly what happened on June 7th. We got a very poor response from the generation. And so when compared to the historical data, it ranks on the lower side, as we can see on this slide. Let's talk about the load response. As I mentioned before, we got a load response of about 2.5, which is which ranks in the middle of the pack when we compare it with all the historical load responses that we observed since 2012. We have seen some high load responses, but most of them were equal to the load response that we got on June 7th or lower. So it's a good story for June 7th. And this is the total combined response of generation and load. And again, when we talk about the total response, again, the orange square is on the lower side of the scale. I think many of the events had better total response, generation and load response, than the June 7th event. And we'll dig deeper into a few of these events, especially the ones where the LSSI was triggered in the past, and we'll see the factors that came into play in the next slides. So here's one where we have taken an event that occurred in 2012. When we lost the intertie with an imports of 569 megawatts, that caused the frequency to dip down to 59.5 hertz. That was the nadir point. And then it recovered and then came back, but it stayed above 59.5 hertz level. In this event, particular event, we had a very poor generator response, very similar to what we observed on June 7th. But because we're talking about 2012, there would be less renewables and the system inertia would be higher. And the amount of disturbance, the 569 megawatts, was not that high. So the frequency dropped to just 59.5. The nadir point was at 59.5 and the frequency was able to recover very quickly and stayed above the 59.5 hertz level. And so there was no under-frequency load shedding in this event. Let's look at another event that occurred in 2013, where we lost a little more load as a result of the intertie trip. And that resulted in the frequency coming down to below 59.5 for a short period of time. That resulted in 145 megawatts of load shed LSSI getting triggered. And that helped the frequency to recover and go back up. It did come down a little bit, but it stayed above 59.5 hertz level. And so there was no under frequency load shedding in this case. And let's look at the third event where we had the LSSI trigger. This was in 2015. And this was a big disturbance where we lost 739 megawatts as a result of the tri-trip. And we see the frequency dripping down to 59.5, barely touching it. And that would cause the LSSI to trigger. We shed 133 megawatts of load, but then the frequency recovered and stayed around 59.7 hertz. And so there was no under frequency load shedding in this case. And now we can, the reason why we are presenting all these graphs, and we have one more here, is to just bring home the point that it's a complex phenomena. Whenever there's a disturbance, there are a number of factors that come into play. Of course, the amount of disturbance is one, and then there's inertia at the time of the disturbance determines the nadir point, and then the generator response. And if there's high inertia, the nadir point is not that low. It's easier for the frequency to recover, even if there is a lower generator response, as we have seen in different events. Here's the last event that we are we've presented here. It's a loss of 410 megawatts of import as a result of the tri-trip that caused the frequency to come down very close to 59.5 hertz, but it did not touch that level, and it recovered from slightly above 59.5. So there was no LSSI that got triggered and no UFLS. But the amount of disturbance, the volume of disturbance was also smaller than the previous three cases that we've seen. So that was a historical perspective. Let's focus on what happened on June 7th. Let's focus on the under-frequency load shedding scheme. I'll go into a little bit of details here. We have different blocks of under-frequency load shedding relays. And the D1 block triggers when the frequency touches 59.3 hertz for 15 seconds. The D2 block triggers when the frequency touches the 59.5 hertz level for 30 seconds. And the D3 block triggers when the frequency touches 59.5 and remains there for 60 seconds. We are showing the performance and non-performance by the background colors. The green shows the feeders that were supposed to trip, actually tripped. So it shows performance. And the yellow shows the non-performing feeders. So, for example, in the D1 block, 44 feeders tripped as they were supposed to, amounting to about 131 megawatts, but four feeders did not trip, and there is a small amount of load associated with them, 9 megawatts. Similarly, in D2, we see 26 feeders tripped, but corresponding to about 75 megawatts of load, but 15 feeders did not trip. Now we have grayed out the D3 block because the D3 block gets triggered when the frequency touches 59.5 for 60 seconds or remains below that for 60 seconds. On the June 7th event, as you recall, the frequency was hovering around 59.5 for a long time, for about 4 minutes. But our observation was that it never remained below 59.5 for 60 seconds or more. But still, we saw 8 feeders tripping as part of the D3 block. So we are still investigating this issue, and we are having conversations with the DFOs and TFOs and looking at investigating the reasons why it happened. And that's why we have grayed out the D3 columns here instead of showing them with green and yellow. So in summary, for D1 and D2, 70 feeders tripped on June 7th, amounting to about 206 megawatts of load shedding, the under frequency load shedding, but 19 feeders did not trip. And so approximately 48 megawatts of load did not get shed. And the conclusion is that we have under frequency load shedding scheme as a safety net, but it did not perform 100%. We did not get 100% performance from that. And so we are looking into it. We are exploring, we are investigating, and having conversations with the DFOs and TFOs on this. Let's talk about the load shed service for imports. These are loads that are contracted, and these loads are shed instantaneously when the frequency goes touches 59.5, of course, with a small time period within 12 cycles or 200 milliseconds. That includes the relay sensing time and the breaker opening time. So at the time of the event on June 7th, there were five providers, and the total LSSI that was armed was around 181 megawatts. And when the event happened, 162 megawatts approximately tripped within the stipulated 200 milliseconds. And so again, we see that we did not get 100% performance from the LSSI safety net. And we are in conversation with the providers, and we are interested in immediately rectifying this situation. So that was about the load shed service for imports. Let's focus on the generator frequency response performance. Dennis did talk about it in his introductions. Let's do a deeper dive here. And this is driven by our rule 502.5, the generator unit technical requirements, which requires that all generators with the maximum authorized real power of greater than 10 megawatts are required to have a continuously acting governor, and it should be responsive to the frequency, system frequency excursions. And the generator droop setting must be between 3 and 5%. So the generator performance is driven by this rule, or is required under this the 502.5 rule. And we have included an ideal response just for reference, which is superimposed on the frequency response that we got on June 7th. Of course, the red line shows the frequency, actual frequency response on June 7th. The green line would be an ideal generation response, where immediately after the event, there would be a governor action. There will be a power boost. And then it will gradually come down, but it will still stay up until the frequency starts its trajectory towards 60 hertz. And that would be an ideal case. And you can see that after the initial power boost, the power would stay up and provide support to the frequency, which is hovering around 59.5 hertz for a long time. However, in our observation, most of the generators did not provide that required frequency response. And these were about 25 assets that underperformed on June 7th. And only a handful of generators provided an appropriate response, which is less than 10 assets. And that added to the complexity, that added to the system underperformance. We also observed that renewable resources did not provide any primary frequency response, but that may have been because I remember on that day it was stormy, it was windy, and so there was high wind generation. So there may not be enough, and there may not be any headroom available for the wind generation to provide any primary frequency response. So that was just an observation. So what we've done here is we've taken the actual responses from the generators from June 7th and categorized them into good, concerning, and poor buckets. So here's the first example of a good response. We have purged the names for confidentiality's sake. Generator A provided a good response. It provided a good governor, a primary frequency response, the power boost, and then the power stayed up, although it kept coming down consistently, but it was up considerably during the period when the frequency was hovering around 59.5. So it must have provided some frequency support to frequency to the system. And so we are calling it a good response. Similarly, generator B has a similar response. It's again with a good power, initial power boost, and then it the withdrawal, we notice the withdrawal in the generator, is the output is coming down at a faster pace, but still would provide help to the frequency that is around 59.5. And here's the third example of a good response, where we have a good power initial power boost, and then the power remained up for the whole period when we needed some frequency support. So these were the three examples from the June 7th event where we saw a good response from the generators. Now let's go to the not so good responses, the generator D. Here we see at the time of the event, there's no substantial initial power boost, but the power started to increase. And so directionally, it's a good response, but it's a very slow response. Once the generator output hit the maximum 145 megawatts, it would have provided help to the frequency, provided support to the frequency. Another example of the concerning response that we got is shown, the generator frequency response with the concerning category. Sorry, on page 41, slide 41 here, where we saw a very small initial power boost, but then the generator started to increase its output, and the rate of change was very slow, but it was still directionally okay, and it would have provided some support to the system frequency. And now let's go to the third category, the poor response, where actually we didn't get any response. As you can see, when the event happened, generator F did not respond at all. And then it went the other way, so that would have been actually detrimental. But for all practical purposes, we can consider the response as flat without any support. And similarly, the generator G is the same. There was absolutely no response at the time of the event, and then it went the other way. Here, generator H had a small response, which was barely noticeable, but it died down very quickly, and then it went the opposite way, and then remained flat. Generator I is very similar to the previous response. J has some initial power boost, but again, it dies very quickly and goes the other way. And so we have considered it as a poor response. Generator K is very similar to what we have seen. I'm on slide 47 here. You have an idea of what we got on June 7th in terms of good response, concerning response, and poor responses. I think it's another opportune time, good time to break and take questions before we go into the next steps and mitigation measures. I'll go to the Q&A.
So Ada, just before you start the Q&A, Horst from Suncor had his hand up for a while you were talking. I'm not sure if you answered his question, but...
Let's have him ask that question.
Yeah, so let me, Horster, I will allow you to talk if you would like to unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hi, can you actually hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, excellent. Can you just speak up a little bit?
Okay, I'll try to move a little closer to the microphone.
Thank you.
So I actually had a bunch of questions around the entire generator section. So I don't want to kind of hog the time here. So I actually put one in the chat. Maybe that's the most important one initially that I'm interested in, is in your ideal response slide. So that would have been slide 35, I believe. If we looked at a generator that has everything else the same, just a MARP of 85 megawatts, where would you, how would this curve look differently? And I'm particularly interested in that period where the 100 megawatt generator just went clearly up to whatever 90 something. What would you expect for the kind of the generator with the lower AC at the time?
So it should provide an output according to its droop settings. And then it will also depend on the available headroom. And so we would expect, depending on where it is prior to the event, we would expect them to provide at least some response, some power boost. And then because the frequency was lingering around 59.5 for a long time, we would expect the generator to remain high to provide that necessary support. I can't pinpoint at the level if it's 85 megawatt generator, but we would expect the generator to have a similar response with an initial power boost, depending on the availability of the headroom, and then stay high to provide that required support.
Thank you.
Carla, are there any other questions? Any raised hands?
No more on the virtual side, so we'll go to the Q&A for right now.
Okay.
Thanks.
There's a question, do all wind and solar farms have wind farm management systems installed such that they have automatic water control based on system requirements? Automatic water control, yes, that's part of our generation interconnection requirements. So I would answer yes. Vijay, if you want to jump in.
For sure, Atta. So yeah, so AVR, yes. I mean, they're all required equip themselves with, like you said, AVR. And just keep in mind, so voltage is reactive. We talk about reactive power. In this case, we're talking about frequency and the system issues with frequency, which are associated with real power. So just to want to make that distinction clear between real power and reactive power.
Are you stating that AGC amount is reduced? No, it's our system operating limits are reduced due to storm limits. In Ontario, for example, and the tie lines between Thunder Bay and Sudbury will go either 50% or 0 megawatts flow rate, depending on proximity of storm, 50 or 100 kilometers. So we are talking about ATC, available transfer capability, not AGC. I apologize for my if I was not clear, it's available transfer capacity, not automatic generation control. So immediately after the event, we put a limit of 550 megawatts on the available transfer capability. And then we relax it once we put in the mitigation measures, and we'll talk about it in the incoming slides. But that's what has been done so far. At the start of the presentation, Dennis mentioned that the reduced ATC is a temporary measure until ISO is confident in the response by generators moving forward for these types of events. Is there an expectation for how long this whole process will take so that import ATC can be restored? So we are going to, first of all, the import ATC has been restored. It's only during inclement weather or lightning storms that we have implemented a new requirement or additional requirement of LSSI. So there's no limit on ATC, but it will depend on the available frequency support services at the time. So that's one thing. And do we have it? How long this process will take? Dennis mentioned, I mean, in the next, we know that these conversations and the frequency response, the generator response conversations and issues will not be addressed overnight. It will take time. So we anticipate that in the next 6 to 12 months, we should be able to develop a plan for all the poor performers and have the plans implemented and address this this issue. So we're looking approximately 6 to 12 months to address these issues that we observed on June 7th. So what are the reasons for lower inertia in 2020 versus 2019? One reason, of course, is the COVID-19, which resulted in a reduced demand. So that would be one reason. The other reason would be the renewables that have been added on the system. And they're not a huge number, and I don't have a number with me, but that would also contribute to the lower inertia under certain conditions when we have high wind or high solar as well as heavy imports. Were there any non-response big generators or incorrect response large generators? All of the responses that we have shown in the slides were large generators. We have not presented any. There were generators with a MARP of 70 megawatts or more. Is there any forecasting tool in place to provide information about how much LSSI in the upcoming hours, minutes? BG, you want to take that, please?
For sure. So, So we are looking into some kind of tool development. It's a bit complicated because LSSI, as you know, it's a voluntary service. Loads are price responsive in the province. So there's a whole bunch of combination that needs to be considered before we kind of get the forecast at least reasonably accurate, but that's something that we have in terms of, we have some plans in terms of how we want to approach that in the near future.
Thank you. I'd like to move to the last section for the sake of time. I mean, we have 20 minutes and then we can take the remaining questions there. So let's talk about the mitigation measures and the next steps. So as we have just discussed, immediately after the event, we put a limit on the ATC available transfer capability, was held at 550 megawatts until additional mitigation measures were implemented. And this is because immediately after the event, we did not know what worked, what did not, what had happened. We were in the investigating and gathering information and data, and we did not want to have a repeat of the June 7th event. And so until we were sure about what exactly worked and what did not, we did not want to take that chance. So we put a limit on the ATC at 550 and then started working on gathering data, collecting information, and doing some additional studies. And then by June 22nd, we were ready to implement the additional mitigation measures. And we came up with the two-step mitigation measures. In the first step, we identified some additional volumes of LSSI, load shed service for imports, that would provide us with a higher confidence level. The study was based on a generator response of 90 megawatts per 0.1 hertz and 1.9% of load damping constant. And then we added some additional 95 megawatts of LSSI on top of the LSSI requirement to ensure about 90% confidence level. And then in addition, we also put in an inertia check, because so far in our LSSI volume calculation, we had not brought in system inertia into the picture. So we brought in the system inertia calculations, which we had already identified by late last year. And this is actually an equation where we subtract LSSI from the scheduled ATC and divide that by the system inertia. And the number that we obtain needs to be lower than 0.0135. And this is a number that was obtained after analyzing about 7 or 8 historical events and coming up with this number. So the system inertia check helps us prevent, take into account the lower inertia conditions, should these conditions be prevailing at the time. So we are very confident that with these, with this two-step mitigation approach, we have about 90% confidence level for our imports. And in case we observe that this ratio is higher than 0.0135, then our procedure is to reduce the ATC until we obtain 0.0135 or lower. And as a result, this is the new LSSI arming table, the revised arming table that is now in place in the control room, and that was put in into that was implemented on June 22nd. And then on top of it, we had this additional mitigation measures that we have already discussed as part of the Q&A. This is the safe operating procedure, and that kicks in when we observe lightning, inclement weather in the Alberta BC tie line corridor. As we've discussed before, nearly half of the sustained outages are caused by adverse weather, mainly lightning. So we carried out some additional studies, and in those studies, we assumed a generator response of 40 megawatts per 0.1 hertz that we actually observed on June 7th, and during the June 7th event, an average load damping constant. And based on these assumptions, we came out with an additional requirement for LSSI, only to be implemented when there are when there is a lightning storm passing through the Alberta BC tie line corridor. And so, and here is the safe operating procedure arming levels, which have an added requirement of LSSI volumes on top of what was implemented in June 22nd. So the next steps are that we are still investigating what worked, what did not, why the third block of under frequency load shedding scheme triggered. So we are having ongoing discussions with the DFOs and trying to find out the reasons for triggering the third, the D3 block. We have investigated and reviewed the generator performance during the June 7th event, and we are going to start conversations, as Dennis mentioned in his introduction. These conversations will take place at the senior level as well as at the working level. And we'll be happy to sit down with the asset owners and come up with a plan to address this issue and implement it in the next 6 to 12 months. And at the same time, we will be, as Dennis mentioned, reviewing the need to change our rules perhaps, and see if that will help address this this issue. At the same time, we are going to be talking to our peers in other jurisdictions having conversations with NERC and WEC and look at their recommendations. This is not a unique event. I mean, everybody is facing the similar issues in their jurisdictions. So we are going to be talking to the broader technical community and appropriate stakeholders of how to address all these issues that we have talked about for the June 7th event. We are internally working on an ancillary services roadmap that will identify the need or otherwise of, for example, for synthetic inertia, for renewables, for looking at the possibility of adding HVDC back-to-back converter station on MATL line. This was identified in our long-term plan as well. We are looking at, for example, the participation, technology-neutral providers for frequency support services, for example, facilitating the participation of energy storage in frequency support services. So all of these exercises are currently underway in our organization, and we are looking at the bigger picture here. I think that is it for this presentation, and I do see raised hands, so I'll Carla, if you can help me get to Tracy.
Absolutely. So, Tracy, all right. Tracy, you're just going to have to unmute yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is a question. I just wondered, is this performance from this event may require now that, is there a requirement now for the ASO to carry more operating reserve to have online at all times, like synchronized reserve, I should say?
My apologies. I was not able to understand.
Okay. Yeah, open up my, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, barely. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
I'm just wondering, usually system event performance, if there's an event that doesn't go quite right, I know in the MPCC mandate is to require the control area to carry more operating reserve, synchronized operating reserve online until the next event or so many months down the road. Does that happen in the in Alberta ESO as well? Do we get penalized because of that? Or
no, in my opinion, once the tide trips, we become an island. And so the reliability coordinators or MPCC or WCC is not very concerned about our impact on other jurisdictions, because we were islanded with the tide trip and the metal tide trip with it. So we were on our own.
Mm-hmm. So it's our own burden. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
So Ada, we've got Aaron. And Aaron, if you can just state your name of your organization and unmute yourself.
You're still muted, Aaron.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe while Aaron,
there he is.
Aaron, if you want to go ahead with your question. Okay. Maybe we'll go to Horace from Suncor.
Hello?
Yeah, you're good.
Good. Okay. At least one connection works. Dennis, you mentioned early on in the presentation that you are also looking at what potentially needs to change in the rules. I'm curious as to when that is going to start, because, I mean, after the event, we immediately kind of looked at, okay, did we perform as required, and what was actually required from us? And we realized that there was actually a lot of lack of clarity, at least in our view, in the rules. And so even without looking at additional requirements, maybe just clarifying what the intent of the rules is would already be very helpful. And that's, I think, something that could happen fairly quickly.
Thanks for that, Horst. I think two things on that. Obviously, as we engage with the asset owners, we'll be very open to clarifying rules and expectations, and hopefully working with those asset owners to see if there's any particular changes that will improve performance. We'd like to understand what those are and how long it would take to actually implement those. I would describe it in parallel. Internally, we'll look at the rules to see if there's anything incremental we need to do. To be frank, my preference is to have the asset owners help with improving their performance versus having to go to a rule change to bring incremental consequence to generators in the province to respond. So that's my preferred approach, but obviously we'll look at it in parallel to see if there's anything incremental we need to do within the rules to help.
And sorry, maybe to clarify that the question is, I feel that in certain circumstances, it's not actually clear what's required from the rules. So it's not about the generator not trying to kind of do its best to do what they think is required, but maybe not understanding what is required or what the intention was of the rule. So it's not about additional implementation at the generator or additional rules or penalties. I would agree on that. It's more, let's clarify as to what you wanted to see or what you think the rules should say and how we interpret the rules or what they actually say.
Yeah, if there's a difference in understanding between what we think the rule is asking the generators to respond and how, and it's not clear, then we can work to clarify expectations. And if there's nothing material required at the asset owner side to implement to meet those expectations, then great. So I just wanted to be clear that we're looking at things in parallel. And as again, I said before, Horst, I'd much rather we work with the asset owners, both for clarity of expectation, if that's what the gap is, or see if there's any areas for improvement without the plant that can help us get better response. That would be my preferred outcome than going through a rule change process.
I agree. Thank you.
Okay.
Carla, there are three raised hands, right?
Yeah. So let's try Aaron again. So Aaron, if you want to unmute yourself and you go ahead.
All right. Does it work better this time?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Given the events of June 7th, I was wondering if there's renewed urgency to prioritize interchange restoration projects. I know that, for example, Ada, you had mentioned back to METL, and that's in the long-term plan. Is there any plan to expedite that and move that up in the nearer future, I suppose? And sorry, this is Aaron Tang from BHE Canada.
Okay. Aaron, thank you for your question. As I mentioned, it's part of the Axley Services roadmap that we are currently working on. And as part of that, we will look at different options, and certainly the HVDC back-to-back converter or metal line is one of the options. So we look at it, and depending on what comes out of the studies and urgency, we will come out with the recommendations. So just stay tuned and let us do our work, and then we'll come up with some recommendations.
I think I'll just tag on to
that.
Tag on to that for Ada. Obviously, we had in our long-term plan to look at the HVDC back-to-back. Mm-hmm. Part of that plan is to start working that in the latter half of this year. I would expect by mid next year, we'll have the analysis and kind of decision recommendation path identified. And if it's worth pursuing after we've gone through that analysis, then we'll work that forward. If it's not, then we won't. But you can probably expect over the next 6 months to a year, we'll get to a decision point on that specific part of our long-term plan.
Thanks.
Ada, we'll go to Joe. This might be from TransAlta, but please unmute yourself. And there you go.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
we can.
Perfect. Yeah, so two questions. First, would additional regulating reserve help manage this going forward? And as we've reduced the regulating reserve that we currently procure, doesn't that make this more of a problem? And second, why the AESO doesn't procure more contingency reserve, as wouldn't this increase the current ATC?
So thank you for your question. I would say that as we have discussed in the slides, this event was a combination of a number of factors. It was not just one factor. I mean, it was a combination of many factors. Poor generation response, and then LSSI and UFLS performances, lower inertia. So when we analyze and come up with the recommendations, we have to look at all these factors before coming up with the mitigation measures for the longer run. So yeah, we will definitely consider the regulating reserves as one of the solutions, but it's not the complete picture. It's part of the bigger puzzle.
Procuring less regulating reserve, doesn't this make this more of a problem?
I'm gonna jump in.
Sure. And
then Adam Bijou, correct me if I'm wrong. From a regulating reserve perspective, we're not procuring regulating reserve to deal with contingencies. We're procuring it to deal with ongoing matching of frequency.
But isn't frequency response?
Of course, it would assist, but that's not the intent of regulating reserve. And so, sure, we could procure thousands of megawatts of regulating reserve to deal with contingency if we wanted to, and it would help. But then we'd be running 1,000 megawatts of regulating reserve all the time, which wouldn't be a very economic way to deal with the issue at hand. So the regulating reserve is to deal with the near-term regulating part of our market side and our system. On the contingency reserve, I'll pass that to Adam Bijou to talk about procuring more contingency reserve.
Sure. And Joe, just to add to the fact, I think the initial slide that Arta had that talks about timelines. So keep in mind that regulating reserve is a product that satisfies anything in the seconds time frame. So that's 30, 40, 50 seconds. What we see when we're talking about a system impact and the shock it produces to the system that happens in the first few cycles or the first few seconds, in wherein the secondary frequency control is not effective, we need a primary frequency response. So that's primarily through generators, and we went through the whole generator response. And we also looked at inertia. So those are the two key factors that play a role in determining how your nadir point is. So regulating reserve is more in the variability in the seconds to, a lot of seconds, kind of a minute to a 10 minutes time frame is where regulating reserves help. So procuring more reserves would not address this issue, regulating reserves specifically. And the same goes for contingency reserves as well. Again, contingency reserves, as you can see on the slide, it's tertiary frequency response. It's not primary. So again, what we need is a system support that happens within the first few seconds. And that is not something that we can procure, 1,000 megawatt, maybe 2,000 megawatt of contingency reserve. But to Arta's and Dennis's point, first of all, it's not efficient. Second, it doesn't even help us in maintaining that system reliability perspective in the first few cycles when these are just too slow for us. And that's where we need the inertia and the primary frequency response to help us, go through this process and then kind of, stabilize the system. And then, of course, we have secondary and tertiary kick in, and of course, they can help. But the issue is primarily in the first block from a primary frequency control perspective.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
We're right at, we've got a minute left. If you want to add, if you want to tackle one Q&A question, and we also have one more raised hand. Just Joe that.
Okay, so I'll take the short question. Was there any generation dropped during the June 7th event? I don't think we have information about generation getting dropped during the June 7th event.
That's right, Arta. Yes, yeah, we didn't see any generator tripping,
All right, we've got one more virtual hand, which will lead us into the end of the session. This is with Greg. Greg, you just have to unmute yourself and ask your question. There you go.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Greg.
Hi, Ada. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. So the current RAS scheme for the Path 1 and Path 83 has a trip of metal occurring when there's a fault on the BC Hydro. So one of the things we talked about when you did the original Path 83 modeling way, way back in the day was whether or not metal could stay connected for a trip of the BC Hydro. One of the things that is obvious from that kind of scenario would be it would mitigate the trip of the generation. In this particular event, it looked like you had about 900 megawatts that dropped off immediately, which we're trying to mitigate for.
Mm-hmm.
And so is your plan going forward going to include any modeling which would potentially allow for isolation of metal, but not necessarily tripping at the 120S, so that the generation from within Montana could continue to operate and potentially mitigate for the dramatic drop in the megawatts during this kind of an event?
Yeah, as Dennis mentioned, I mean, we just talked about the option of putting a HVDC back-to-back converter on metal. That will disconnect the relationship between MATL and the Alberta BC tie line. We will not have to cross-strip MATL when the BC tie line goes. So that is part of the bigger picture that's identified in our long-term plan. And once that happens, we will not have to trip MATL. MATL can stay on regardless of whether the Alberta BC tie line is in or not.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think, Carla, we are out of time, is it? So we will take the Q&A that are in this Q&A sheet. we can take it away. This is being, we will have these questions and we'll provide responses to these questions in the next couple of weeks. So thank you, participants, for your time, for your questions, for your interest. I know we took some time to have this webinar. We wanted to gather information and be sure of what worked, what did not work. So thank you for your patience and thank you for your participation. Take care. Bye-bye.
Perfect. Thank you.